Hey, good day, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the OIG Roundtable. Have the whole team here together. Matt Kachansky, retired leader from the HHS OIG, the Office of Investigations, where we all came from, the retired Northeast UPIC director, and now our senior manager of our SIU team. Wade McFall, retired assistant special agent in charge from the HHS OIG Office of Investigations, and now a manager on our SIU investigative team. And Jason Eisengrein, our special director in charge, who is a retired leader from HHS OIG Office of Investigations and also retired Western UPIC director. And Jason is actually just finished up on an on-site for a client at a provider location. So maybe we'll get to talk a little about that when we get to some discussions later today on the topic for today. And I am still Eric Rubenstein, the Senior Director of Litigation, Fraud, Waste, Abuse Support. So today we want to revisit some stuff that we've talked about previously, but we've actually gotten some feedback from some of both of our client SIU teams, our internal SIU teams, and just some of the general public that tend to tune into these when we put them out every week. And it was to revisit some of the discussions regarding referrals. And referrals take a couple of different categories, right? Referrals can be to external stakeholders. They don't always have to go to law enforcement. So there's external stakeholders, but from the law enforcement perspective, you've got your Medicaid fraud control units if you are an SIU for a Medicaid plan. If you're a Medicare Advantage plan, you're making your referrals typically to the Medic, which is the CMS contractor for that. And if you're a commercial payer, you could be making a referral to the state prosecutor's office. It could be going to the FBI or something along those lines. And then obviously HHS OIG gets referrals from the UPICs, the Unified Program Integrity Contractors, where Matt and Jason were directors. By the way, we recently brought on a third individual named Brad Smith, who is working on our investigative team, who was the Southeast UPIC director. So I'm really proud of the fact that over here at Advise, we have three former UPIC directors of the five UPICs that are out there. So that's really going to be very helpful with working with our clients in the future. But so getting back, we also have internal stakeholders that have to be thought about. And those internal stakeholders, you could be making referrals to a separate payment integrity group, a policy group, provider enrollment, provider education. And they may work very closely with other external stakeholders, such as licensure and regulatory body. So it's important to understand that. But we're going to focus today pretty much on referrals that go out to primarily the law enforcement community. And there are good referrals, there are bad referrals, there are a whole bunch of things that have to be taken into effect for that. Now, you know, one thing that's interesting is when we talk a lot in these podcasts, we talk a lot about establishing a solid working relationship with the law enforcement community. If you are working in the commercial space, it's knowing who those external law enforcement stakeholders are. If you're working in the Medicaid space, it's really being able to interact with your Medicaid fraud control units. Something that's interesting is, you know, CMS operates a group within CMS known as the Center for Program Integrity. It used to be called the Program Integrity Group. It's had a couple of different names, a couple of iterations. It's currently known as the Centers for Program Integrity, or CPI. But back in 2008, the predecessor group put out a short 9-page, 8-page document that is entitled, I'm showing it here on the screen, Best Practices for Medicaid Program Integrity Units, Interactions with Medicaid Fraud Control Units. There'll be a link to this with the newsletter and the recording for this. There'll be a link to this. But, you know, we've talked a lot about the importance of liaisoning with law enforcement and the importance of interacting with law enforcement. And, you know, this was not a document that we were really familiar with. I found it this morning in preparation for putting together today's podcast with the group. And the number one recommendation is to meet regularly with MFUCU. And they have a bunch of recommendations. Again, we're going to put this into the chat. But we're going to talk about that interaction that should go on. But I want to start with you, Wade, because there are good referrals, there are bad referrals, and you've had opportunities to both review referrals from the OIG perspective, but then also put referrals together for one of our Medicaid clients, and then interact with the different organizations. And, you know, uniquely, we have to work with two or three organizations in some states. And so there are some things they're going to be looking at. And I know one of the things that we always talk about are these benchmarks. What is going to be interesting to a MFUKU or the single state payer on a referral? What is not going to be interesting? And some of the things about, you know, the dollar amounts and things of that sort. And so when you're looking to put together a good referral, and let's talk specifically about referrals that you've made to the state MFUKU where we were doing some work in New Jersey, what were some of the successes that you had? And what were some of the things that you thought were going to be successful as far as getting a referral accepted and not successful?
Well, I'd say generally there was not a lot of success. There were several referrals that were accepted, quote unquote accepted. So we assumed that they were working them, but in most cases we would get them kicked back a couple months later once they've looked into them a little bit. And I think the main reason for that and the issue with the referrals was, as you said, one is the threshold, the dollar amount is an issue. But more importantly is the kind of making the delineation between what is waste, what is abuse, and what is fraud. You know, I think maybe that's not, it seems kind of obvious to us who've been in this business for years, but I think to some, maybe in the MCOs, that they're not as familiar with it because they haven't worked the cases like in a criminal level, specifically the fraud angle on it. You know, we can go into like definitions of waste is basically just unnecessary or excessive healthcare resources that results in higher costs. Abuses, you know, I guess just inconsistent acceptable medical practices that again result in unnecessary costs. But the fraud angle that is really missing, in my opinion, in a lot of these referrals is, and I think someone else was going to talk about this later, but intent. It's all about intent. If it's a criminal referral, you have to show intent. And the referrals that I saw going out, we certainly didn't establish that by what you would normally do, consider like interviews and that type of thing. And that's something that is assumed that, you know, once you refer it to the MFUKU, they would probably end up having to do interviews later, but we didn't, you know, working remotely, we really didn't. We'd do some phone interviews, but they weren't very quality interviews. But it's really, you know, it gets down to realizing what you have to include to be able to prove that intent. And that's got to be, you know, it's going to be like memos or emails or statements from other people, you know, those types of things that you can. I mean, intent is the one thing when you go to pitch a case to a prosecutor, that's the focus, because if it's a criminal case, it's going to what you can show that stuff was billed illegally and things of that nature, but the intent is always the key point. And that's what the referrals that I saw going out didn't really have any element of intent included. And part of that was because there was a mandate at a certain point where you're supposed to send a credible allegation of fraud, when in fact, a lot of these investigations should have been categorized as waste or abuse. And they should be, you know, worked as maybe not a referral, but, you know, trying to get the money back, suspensions, revocations, that type of thing. But they just didn't have that fraud, criminal, intentional element to the cases. They were more cases that were worked through data mining or, you know, CPC review, but they weren't fraud cases. So that's another issue. You send a bunch of these cases to the MFUKU and they keep looking at them and they don't meet their threshold, whether it be a dollar threshold or an intent threshold. So they're, you know, they're tired of going through these cases that really don't amount to anything. They try and work some of them, they work them for a couple months, and they could come back saying, you know, we're declining this.
Yeah, and that becomes the challenge, because as an SIU investigator, it's very hard for you to develop the requisite evidence to be able to demonstrate intent. SIUs do not have subpoena authority. They don't have the ability to take sworn statements, right? Certainly don't have the ability to execute search warrants and arrests. and things of that sort, don't have the ability to compel people to turn over documents or to talk to you about certain things. And those become sometimes the pieces of the puzzle when you're talking about something like intent to come up with that. So I think that's where we still get back to this premise that we harp on, I think, ad nauseum about the constant communication with Mifuku, so that we aren't all spinning our wheels, and if there's something that can be dealt with in a way other than that. So this actually brings me, Jason, I want to go to you because, you know, Wade brings up the important point. And obviously, look, that document that I just put up on the screen a minute ago, you know, the very first thing that it mentioned was regular communication with the Mifuku, because that helps you to develop what it is the Mifuku is interested in, what are the things that they want to look for intent. You know, I don't know of any instances where the Mifukus were giving training, or at least the lawyers who do the prosecutions of Mifuku cases were giving training to kind of discuss these. But there are some things that are out there in the space where you can work to demonstrate intent. You know, the one that I think we talk a lot about, previous audits and experience with the provider with previous audits, and then the CMS or equivalent version of what they call the TPE, the Targeted Probe and Education, where you can show a pattern of behavior or something like that. And then finally, you're doing it right now. You just finished an on-site at a provider's office in which some of the things that you might have seen or not seen could be indicia of fraud, waste, abuse, right? So as investigators, we're not in a position to say something is fraud, something is waste, something is abuse. Those are kind of legal definitions. We can certainly talk about indicia of those things. So these are factors that you would, you know, that we can use within the SIU world.
Yes, and I think you and Wade covered the point of intent really well for the purpose of a podcast. There's certainly a lot more that we could talk about in terms about what ends up being the fodder for intent. So, you know, you said it, you know, former education is always a key one, but where to get that education from, that can be just a little bit interesting and tricky. So it, and I remember, Eric, you giving I formerly contracted with you to provide some training to a group of Medicaid integrity investigators on sources of information. So, you know, there isn't, you know, if you go to John Jay College for Criminal Justice, there isn't, you know, a textbook on all the sources of information. So learning about who your sources are and what your customers are and who your customers are, or I should say stakeholders are, is really important. So I'll take the intent piece to another level, which is, I thought it was interesting that this document in 2008, it talks about Mifukus, which, so there might be some people on here that don't know that that's the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit. And they have been, you know, the primary law enforcement, state law enforcement agency looking at Medicaid fraud over the years. But frankly, it's grown well beyond that. And again, because I've said this before, at the risk of sounding like we're just trying to generate business for advice, knowing who to communicate to, who to pitch your cases to, and what's of interest to them is really important, because you could be spending a whole lot of money developing issues that are just not for that particular stakeholder. So at state levels, just to give a little sampling, even in the world of the Mifuku, some Mifukus are divided into one side that's doing the financial crimes part of it, and then there's another side that's doing patient abuse. So if you're pitching something about a false claim to the patient abuse people, they probably, you know, they may care about it, but they probably don't have the resources to work on it. And frankly, even helping you find those stakeholders could be time consuming for them. So at the other agencies at the state levels, the Office of Medicaid Inspectors General that have been popping up all over, and even there, there's an audit side and an investigative side. Some states, if it's a pharmacy issue, there are some branches of state police organizations that take the pharmacy issues. And I could really go on from there. There are so many of them. And in the Western UPIC, where there were 13 states and three territories, it was a full-time job as a law enforcement liaison to know who you would route the concern to. So I would suggest that, you know, when intent is part of it, even that the intent is related to the organization that you're pitching the case to is going to be important. And I'll leave it there.
Yeah, I mean, that's an important piece. And part of that in understanding that intent is, you know, not every case that you get is going to be a case that results in some finding that's a credible allegation of fraud with intent. I mean, part of the landscape that we're in now is in the data analytics space is, you know, there are a lot of data analytics vendors out there. And the problem with all of them is that they make promises of generating a large volume of cases for which no particular SIU could ever handle. You know, we're seeing that with some of the plans that we're working with, where, you know, we've got one plan in particular where they have a data analytics tool that they're using. They had two investigators and they were just able to keep up with their reactive cases. Now they're paying a tool to generate, you know, a spigot of cases. You've got to be able to vet those quickly and make determinations about, do you think that there's an intent issue there or not, based on where you're going. But, you know, it is a difficult landscape. And for the most part, most of the cases that you're going to work are not going to be intent cases. There may be intent. You just may not be able to prove the intent because of those limitations. So, you know, the important piece on intent is if you can show a prior history. And Jason, you brought up something, which is, you know, where are you getting your training and education from? And I think one of the important things that we see in a lot of these cases, particularly in the device space, is that providers will submit claims based upon coding guidance that comes in from the manufacturer. And that's not appropriate. But does that make it criminal? And I think that's really the question. If you take bad advice from someone, does that make you a criminal, or does that just make you someone who's in that waste abuse piece? I mean, I think you have to clearly look at the facts of that. You know, for example, is a provider using a transcranial Doppler machine and every patient has got a particular diagnosis and that diagnosis was made up, right? That's a fine line for intent. But if a provider is using that device and there's some prior history of that diagnosis, but that device just may be used for an inappropriate use or something like that, then you might, you know, get out of that intent piece. But the intent piece is always a big challenge. So Matt, the last piece of this puzzle is, you know, when you are looking to make that referral, you know, one of the things that we know these organizations, the law enforcement organizations, are always looking at is what's the dollar amount? And what's the substantiation of that allegation through things like member interviews? And we already know that member interviews can be hit or miss. And obviously, you know, you have to take that with a little bit of a grain of salt. But the dollar amounts are always going to be the question. What is the right dollar amount? If you're talking about a Mufuku referral and it's Medicaid, the dollar amounts may be substantially lower, right? The commercial dollars or Medicare may be substantially higher. But then the other piece of this is that oftentimes the dollar amounts that are identified are based upon either probe sampling or statistical sampling. And we already know that there are some states that poo-poo statistical sampling. They want actual dollars. And so your actual dollars are never going to come out to be as large as they potentially could be, right? And that becomes kind of that last piece of the puzzle in that referral is the question really is, what's the right dollar amount? What's the right number of interviews? What's the right anything?
Yeah. I think to answer that, you go back to that first recommendation of the CMS report. Meet consistently with the Mufuku or the end user of the referral. Who's going to be looking at this referral? Who's going to be using it to build a case and then present a case to a prosecutor? All of those answers, you know, how many interviews, what's the dollar thresholds, what's the amount of work that a SIU should put into a referral, and how far should they go to find intent? All of those answers are written within the relationship you have with the people that you're going to be sending those referrals to. So I'll give the example of the Northeast you pick. We had three OIG offices that we were working with because we covered at least partially three of their regions. Each one had different amounts of work that they wanted us to do on referrals. In Boston, they wanted us to do they wanted it with a bow. They wanted the interviews done. They wanted the onsites done. They wanted the calculated overpayment. They wanted all of that stuff done so that they could take it to a prosecutor and say, here it is, what do you want us to do with it? Philadelphia, not as much. Sometimes they had ideas for undercovers, so they didn't want us to go on site or talk to the provider. They didn't want us to go get medical records sometimes. It was just based on the type of case and who, what district it was going to. New York, they never wanted us to do anything in terms of anything that would compromise a potential covert operation, because that's how their prosecutors wanted to develop cases for prosecution. They didn't want historical cases. They wanted to send somebody in and get the evidence live. If we were to go in as a UPIC, that's going to put the provider on guard, and they would change their behavior, and their case would be screwed. So we had to work with those parameters on how much work to put into a case based on where it was going to end up. The other thing is thresholds. You know, a case in New York, in Manhattan, a $50,000 case, that's never going to get accepted. In Vermont, good chance of it. And it's the same on the Medicaid side. You know, Medicaid in New York, it's still going to be big bucks versus, you know, you look at Maryland or Maine. A $10,000 case is a big deal to them. So you have to know those things to be able to build your referrals based on what the priorities and requirements are for the specific audience to where that referral is going. And the other thing is, a referral should never be a surprise. You should be able to discuss potential referrals with the end user, with the recipient, before it's sent. Because you want to make sure that A, they want to see it, and it's something that they're interested in. Is it within their priority areas of such as home health, DME? Are the prosecutors are interested in those areas or not? You always talk about the New Jersey taxis. U.S. Attorney's Office in New Jersey didn't want ambulance cases, so you didn't work those, you know. And, you know, as a UPIC or as an SIU, you should probably know that as well, because if you're working an ambulance case, you should know that that district doesn't want it. So don't work it up as a referral. Use those other administrative actions that Wade talked about to resolve the cases.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, having worked in New York, I know for sure that when we were getting referrals from the UPIC, we really wanted bare bones referrals.
Yep.
And I think, you know, the history of that was that New York had always been the New York region had always been an aggressive investigative region, and we wanted to work the investigations. We didn't want somebody else working them. You know, and for many years, we were actually the region that was called upon to provide investigative and logistical support to other regions, because we did arrests and search warrants and a lot of criminal investigations in an area where a lot of other districts didn't do them. So Jason, I want to go back to you for the last word on this, because you were an agent, you were an ASAC in New York, and so you kind of lived a lot of these things. Some final thoughts on this.
I really want to address the fact that, you know, from an organizational standpoint, and especially in the world of the SIUs, there's a finite amount of resources and budget. And if the organization is spinning its wheels developing something that's not interest to the stakeholder, you've just wasted a lot of resources. And frankly, you know, so. And I thought today's onsite was very helpful to the client. So the client had concerns, and drawing staff away from their everyday duties is problematic and cumbersome because they have other things going on, obviously. Yet they wanted to address this because of the concerns. And we're able to go in. And as I've said on several podcasts, it's about proving or refuting the allegation. Because the thing that would just, it sours everybody's day if they start looking at an over 90, over 120, over 365 day report of cases languishing, and then to find out there's nothing there, it's just really totally against the best interest of the organization. So point being is that you can use either, you know, contracting resources to do some of the on-sites and not take staff away, because a lot of attention then gets diverted to that. Do you have the equipment? Do you have the data? Do you have the research that's done to know the demographics of who the target services and things of that nature? So there might be other ways to attack it, but rather than going down a 6 month long investigation, maybe you do an on-site sooner rather than later and call the question on it. Because you will know usually a lot quicker with getting a hands-on view of what it is you're looking at.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think that's really the point, is you've got to make these determinations kind of early on. And part of that is understanding the moving ball. And I know we've all experienced it, where a case that's accepted this week, a similar case is not accepted the next week because of those changing priorities. If you know those priorities, meaning you're speaking to these organizations on a very regular basis, right? So, you know, I know that in New York, there are some facilitated meetings that go on once or twice a year with all of the stakeholders. The FBI coordinates a meeting with FBI, OIG, and a bunch of other law enforcement stakeholders, and then all of the plans. You know, we participate because we have a large footprint in the New York market. We participate in those. I don't think that's enough. I think that there has to be a greater volume of communication, and whether that be in a formal setting like that or a more regular touch point that should exist, you know, you need to be able to have that. The worst thing that you can have happen is you don't have that communication. You go for 6 or 8 months, you need that communication, and your point of contact is gone. They've left to another agency, they've retired, whatever it is, and you don't know that. And it's been 6 months since you've last had your communication. If you're regularly communicating with people about your needs and what's available, you'll be able to maybe stifle some of that noise that, you know, winds up being out there. So it's a All challenge.
A quick pro tip. If the U.S. Attorney's Office in your jurisdiction has a healthcare fraud coordination meeting or work group that's either quarterly, semi-annually, or whatever, and you're not going to that, you're really doing yourself a major disservice. You want to find out what's of interest to the prosecutor. You want to find out what the other law enforcement agencies are interested in. It's the place to start.
Yeah, and you know, interestingly enough, we're gearing up to do some training and education for a commercial plan in New York, and they weren't aware of the FBI's yearly or twice a year meeting that they have, and you know, we facilitated the introductions to get them onto that because it's an important piece. Even if you have nothing to say at that meeting, it's just a way to make contact with people. The sign-in sheet becomes the most important piece of paper that you can possibly have. So there, you can't ever, you know, someone once told me it's not what you know, it's how big your Rolodex is, right? It's just having the ability to have the contacts of people that you need to talk to. I mean, that's, you know, and I remember, Jason, you can laugh at this, but I do remember shortly after 9/11, when you were doing some stuff, driving around with someone who had two large Rolodexes, and they carried them around in the car. So it is, you know, thank goodness you can now have that all on a cell phone, so you don't have to, you know, seek workman's comp for carrying the double sized Rolodex. But the point is that having those contacts, keeping up with those contacts, which is it's time consuming, but probably something that's going to be the most important piece of being able to understand whether you have a good referral or a bad referral, or something that just is a bad referral that could be a good referral. So, you know, the answer, unfortunately, to a lot of these questions is it depends, right? And you have to know it district by district or stakeholder by stakeholder. So as always, guys, a lot of fun talking to you. Thanks to everybody again for tuning into this week's OIG Roundtable. Again, we've got the link to the CMS document that I put up on the screen from 2008 for your reference. It really does touch upon all the things that we've been touching upon. So it's nice to see that we're at least parroting what are considered to be best practices.
And only 16 years discussion. Behind the times.
And only 16 years behind the times. That's true. So as always, you can get our weekly podcast in our newsletter. You can get it sent to you directly in your inbox every Friday. We're also putting it out on Thursdays as a standalone recording on LinkedIn. Check out our refreshed website, www.advisehealth.com. You can get right on there as a splash screen to sign up for the newsletter. We have our own page for all of the podcasts. It links to our YouTube channel and Spotify, so you can get it there. Also, a couple of weeks from now, we've got middle of May. We've got our next LinkedIn Live. It's going to be, I'm moderating a great conversation with David Bolden, our project manager, our lead auditor, and Renee Sloan, one of the investigators on one of our SIU teams, behavioral health expert. We're going to be talking about behavioral health from both the coding slash auditing and investigative side. We're going to talk about some of the problematic codes, some of the investigative pitfalls that are out there. These are really two amazing subject matter experts that are going to provide you with some really good information that you can take away to your own investigation. So we look forward to that. As always, thanks to you and thanks to everybody. And we'll see you on the next OIG Roundtable.